your need-to-know cultural snapshot of Wisconsin and beyond. This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max, sponsored by Visit Milwaukee, a deep dive into all things intriguing, riveting, and entertaining. Now, here's your host, Sandy Max.
I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy this evening. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be here for the next 3 hours. And, oh, before I forget, Sandy wants to remind you, because she is on vacation, and it's a well-deserved one, but she wants to remind you that she is going to be co-hosting the red carpet for Skylight Music Theater's Tony Awards Watch Party, and that's taking place on June 1st. So if you want to find out more, go to the Skylight Theater website, and I think they can let you know about all of the events going on. Now, we are here until 9 o'clock this evening, and we have a very busy lineup for you tonight. There was a time where you saw neon signs everywhere. Remember that? Well, is it a bygone art? We're going to hear from a Milwaukee artist who specializes in neon and bending glass, and she has a fascinating new exhibit that we're going to tell you about, and the thing she does with neon and glass, you are not going to believe. And speaking of art, the Morning Glory Art Fair returns this weekend to the outdoor grounds of the Marcus Performing Arts Center. And we have not one, not two, but three of the participants joining us a little bit later on. Now, if you ever wondered what goes on behind the scenes when all those stars stop for interviews on the red carpet, we're going to be talking with a former producer for a number of shows, including Regis and Kathy Lee Entertainment Tonight. And she actually worked with Robin Leach on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And you're not going to believe what goes into being a producer on one of these shows and getting these celebrities to talk with you. And she's got a couple of really interesting anecdotes she's going to be sharing with us. Also, have you ever had a Bigfoot sighting? Are you aware there have been over 100 sightings of Bigfoot right here in Wisconsin since the 1970s? Now, most of them occur up north, you know, in Vilas County or up around that area. But believe it or not, you and your kids are going to have an opportunity to search for Bigfoot and maybe win a prize if you're here in the southeastern Wisconsin area. And we're going to tell you about that all tonight on What's on Tap. Isaac's here pushing those buttons. Elizabeth Littinen and Jen Gregg are sharing newsroom duties this evening. And in just 2 minutes, we're going to be back talking about this year's Jazz in the Park. They have a fantastic lineup of musicians, and you're going to hear all about them coming up after this on What's on Tap on WTMJ. It's 6:11. And What's on Tap is sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. Handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org. I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy tonight. And what a show we have lined up. I am so pleased to welcome our next guest. It's Tammy Bockhorst. She is the executive director of Easttown Association. And are you aware, if you've been anywhere around Milwaukee in the last 30-plus years, you probably have been to Jazz in the Park at least once. And they've got a great lineup this year. We're going to tell you all about that. But first of all, good evening, Tammy. It's great to have you here.
Good evening, Libby. I'm excited to be here.
Now, am I correct that Jazz in the Park started more than 30-some years ago?
That's right. It started in the early 90s, and it was part of a neighborhood revitalization project. And to showcase the neighborhood, the local engagement, and just bring eyes and enthusiasm and fun to downtown Milwaukee.
Has it always been at Cathedral Square Park?
To my understanding, yes. It is the longest standing free musical exhibit in Milwaukee, and it's been at Cathedral Square.
Now, the name of it is Jazz in the Park. Is that what it was originally? Because we're going to talk about some of the acts, and it's not necessarily exclusively jazz, but what was the original concept?
Okay, so yeah, I knew you would ask that, and thank you. Yes, it originated as a jazz-themed weekly music opportunity all summer long.
And were they all jazz acts at the beginning? Did you have jazz musicians, or who was playing back in those days?
Oh, those are great questions. Initially, yes, predominantly jazz acts, a lot of local and national acts at the time. The organization had a lot more capital, we'll say, and put a lot of money into attracting some premier jazz performers.
Do you know who any of those were at the time?
I'm sorry, off the top of the head, my head will come back to it. I left my notes the other
I bet room. A lot of our fans out there remember those days, and they can probably share some of the acts that they have seen at Jazz in the Park throughout the years. And if you've got some memories of that, we'd love to hear from you on our Siding Unlimited talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Who have you seen at Jazz in the Park since it began in the early 90s? Well, 30-some years, Tammy. Obviously, it's done something special to retain its popularity. Why does it return every year?
That is a great question. It's free fun in downtown Milwaukee in a beautiful, idyllic setting. Cathedral Square is basically a town square surrounded by businesses. And nowadays, we have more and more residents. So the ability to commune together over a shared love for live music in this setting brings out people from all over. And the fact that it's been free for so long as well and will always continue to be free is magical, wonderful, and attracts more and more people each year.
Well, I mean, the first time I remember hearing of Jazz in the Park, because I wasn't born here. Mm-hmm. I didn't get here until the early 2000s. It was, you grab a blanket, maybe a bottle of wine or something like that, some cheese and crackers, and you just sit on that grass in that beautiful park and listen to music and enjoy it and talk to friends and family while you're there.
That's right. And the experience is equally special today. Of course, there have been changes over the years regarding legislative and others regarding bringing your bottle of wine. But now we also have a full bar. We have full wine, beer, liquor, and all of that. But we also have all the things that bring people back year after year. Great performers, magical scenery, energized crowd, people dancing, and a lot of other artists, entertainers, and vendors that come to the area as well.
Has it always been on Thursday nights?
It has. It's been on Thursday nights as far as I, yes.
Any reason why Thursdays were selected? There's 7 days of the week. It could have been a Tuesday.
Libby, I wish I knew the answer to that question, but I can definitely get back to you on that.
Well, okay. So let's talk about the acts themselves. Mm-hmm. We mentioned before, it isn't just jazz anymore. But how do you select the acts? What's that process?
Okay, that is a great question. I'll get to that. We have an entertainment committee that selects the entertainers. This is comprised of a diverse group of individuals, some radio show hosts as well, and they have experience in the broader musical community. This year in particular, we look to diversify some of our programming. And as you mentioned, it's not just jazz. So we were looking to energize the community, offer something for everyone. And I think we have a pretty neat lineup.
Are they all local acts?
They are. This year, they are. Next year, we will go broach beyond that. But this year, they are local with a twist.
How soon in advance, because obviously you start in June, but how much ahead of time are you looking at acts?
Ideally, we would begin now for next year.
Really?
However, I just stepped into this role in January, so the entertainment committee began about the end of January.
Now, if there are local acts out there that would like to participate, do you have tryouts? How do they submit themselves for consideration?
That is, well, there are a variety of ways. You can go through our website. You could also go through our entertainment committee that's comprised of a variety of individuals. They have deep connections and deep roots. So it's kind of a little bit of word of mouth, a little bit of luck.
We're talking with Tammy Bockhorst. She is the executive director of the Easttown Association. And Jazz in the Park is returning once again this year for 12 weeks steady. Now, last year, as I recall, it wasn't every week, was it?
That's correct. Last year, due to a variety of reasons, the organization at the time decided to go to an every other week format. However, that doesn't really work well when people are counting on weekly jazz and other programming in the park.
Did you hear a lot from the community last year?
We certainly did. There was an overwhelming need or cry to bring it back to a weekly format, and we listened.
Now, when you're hearing from a lot of the people who attend on a regular basis, do they request particular musicians or kinds of music?
It really depends on the person. We get requests across the board. You wouldn't believe it. It's very popular.
Oh, like what sort of requests do you get?
Well, this year, actually, we had a request for some more tribute bands.
Really?
Yes. So, for example, we have...
Don't tell us yet.
Don't tell you
yeah,
yet.
No,
oh,
no,
sorry.
Because we want to hear that. We got to build up to this. So, yeah. So you're hearing that the people of Milwaukee want more tribute acts.
In addition to other types of music. You had mentioned it's Jazz in the Park, and yes, that is still the name. It's the name we've had for a long time. There's been a call. Maybe we should switch it to something else. Because it's not, it hasn't been exclusively jazz for some time, including the jazz community has been saying, maybe it's time to come up with a different name. But we've been around for over 30 years, and you understand the power of branding and continuity. But that doesn't mean that we're not listening and we might not change it. Maybe you'll hear about that tonight, too.
Well, yeah, I think you will. We're talking with Tammy Bockhorst. She is with the Easttown Association. And once again this summer, Jazz in the Park is returning to Cathedral Square Park. And not just every other week like last year. It's going to be every week this year. So we will reveal some of those acts coming up in just a couple minutes on What's on Tap. Tonight, it's going to be clear. We've got a chance of a storm if you're way north. We're going to get down to about 50 degrees, but tomorrow looks pretty nice. Mostly sunny with a high of 72 if you're inland and 64 at the lake. That's our temperature right now. It's 64 at 621 on WTMJ. And Sandy's on vacation this week. I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy. And right now we are talking with Tammy Bockhorst. She's the executive director of Easttown Association, and they are the folks behind Jazz in the Park, which is getting underway on June 4th. Is that a week from Thursday, Tammy?
That is 1 week from tomorrow, yes.
Oh, well, you must be excited. Now, tell us, who is going to be the opening act this year?
Oh, I'm so excited. We're incredibly excited for our June 4th. It's a Salsa in the Park evening with Junior Rivera y su orquestra featuring Salsa Brositas, which is a local salsa dance company.
Oh, so there's going to be dancers and...
Yes.
Now, will there be an opportunity for salsa lessons?
There definitely. So come early. Yes, you'll have salsa lessons. And this is a very popular evening in general, not just because people are ready for summer. But the salsa dancing evening gets people off their seats, onto the floor, spinning around. And we're, yes, lessons or no lessons if you want to lead.
Oh, well, everybody wants to learn salsa. I mean, get those hips going. And if you watch Dancing with the Stars, that's one of their primary dances. So you got to learn that one. All right. So what time next week?
6 p.m. However, get to the park early for our Cathedral Square Market as well.
Ah, okay. Well, we're going to talk about the market in just a couple minutes. But let's talk about June 11th, because this is one that I think a lot of people are going to enjoy, because it's not just one type of music.
That's right. So June 11th, we have Beattie Greer and her Divas. Beattie Greer is a popular Whammy Award-winning musician. She has a variety of compilations of performers that usually join her. This year, very special. She is calling out friends and family from Seattle, Portland, and beyond. So we will have some surprises to come as far as some of her special guests, but it's going to be a spectacular night. I'm really excited.
When you say divas, give us a hint. What divas are going to be featured?
Well, it wouldn't be a secret or a surprise if I told you.
Oh, so you're not going to tell us that? Okay,
I'm
so
not going to tell you at this
you
moment.
You got to be there on June 11th.
You better be there.
All right, well, speaking of divas, I'm looking forward to June 18th, because this is one of my favorite singers, and what a tribute this is going to be.
Fantastic. And you're talking about our Long Live the Queen night, our respect, a tribute to the Queen of Soul.
Aretha Franklin.
Aretha Franklin, exactly. And this night is going to be special for a variety of reasons, Libby. Not only is the band spectacular, ACA Music and Entertainment sponsored this band for this evening. This coincides with, you may have heard of Cecilia the Queen Gilbert. She was a phenom downtown Milwaukee, City Hall, and she passed a little over a year ago. So Friends of Cathedral Square, in conjunction with Downtown Bid and Easttown Association, are hosting an evening in celebration of her, but also because an honorary street sign unveiling will be happening that evening on Jefferson and Jackson and Wells.
Oh.
So we were combining the queens that evening for a really beautiful night.
Oh, that is just going to be fabulous. I love that. Now, when you have any of these acts, and I think a lot of people appreciate that, it's always live bands. Because we're so used to you know, you go someplace and they bring out the machine. And yes, they might be singing, but you don't have a band backing them up. But Jazz in the Park, you always have live musicians.
Historically, we have always had live musicians. We are looking to potentially change that up this year. And we'll talk about that maybe more in the second act of this. But yes, all of the bands in the first half of this are live musicians.
Well, we are almost all through June. So let's go to June 25th. And who do you expect that night?
That evening, we have Driveway Thrift Dwellers. So this is kind of the genre of Americana or a northern country.
What do you mean northern country?
Yeah, I had to look that up myself. So instead of your traditional southern country music, this is country music with a Wisconsin-specific flair.
Oh, okay.
Yes, a five-piece band. I think you'll really enjoy it. We're really excited. They come highly recommended by all of the members of the entertainment committee and many people from the community as well.
Well, every generation has its music. And on July 23rd, you're going to be featuring one decade because you're going to take some time off there during Summerfest. But right. Then you come back on July 23rd. And what decade are you going to be featuring?
On the 23rd, we are featuring the 1980s and some 90s and 2000s, of course. But predominantly, I'd say a lot of people's favorite decade for music, the 1980s.
With the first wave.
Yes, the first wave. So the first wave is more of a new wave, alternative music. But there will be something for everyone. And they'll throw in some twists here and there. They are a crowd. They're fan favorites, crowd pleaser. And if you're a dancer or you like to wear neon, please make it down.
All right. Well, we're going to find out what the rest of the season looks like for Jazz in the Park because we've still got the rest of July, August, and even September. We've got Tammy Brockhurst here. She is with the Easttown Association. And in just a couple minutes, we're going to reveal the rest of those acts this summer. But before we do anything else, it's 6:30. And in the WTMJ Breaking News Center, we have Liz Lintonen. Liz?
What's on Tap with Sandy Max is back on WTMJ.
And I'm Libby Collins, in for Sandy. Well, we were talking about some of those acts that are going to be at Jazz in the Park. And yep, Long Live the Queen on June 18th, a tribute to the Queen of Soul is one of them. But we're only halfway through summer, and we're joined by Tammy Brockhurst, and we're talking about some of those acts to expect. Now, this is one that really intrigues me. July 30th. Midnight in Chicago. Now, what do you mean by midnight in Chicago? Because that can have a lot of connotations.
It certainly can. So July 30th, we have the Ivy Ford Band. She's from Chicago, like many of our wonderful musicians, a child prodigy, started performing at a very, very young age, has an illustrious career, was even in the Chicago Jazz Festival and all over. She grew up in Waukegan, Illinois, and she also co-hosted with or performed with band members from Kenosha and beyond. So it's a beautiful cross-the-border scenario. And what do you mean by midnight in Chicago? Well, we all know in Chicago you can party all night long. So unfortunately, Jazz in the Park ends at 9 p.m. at night, but we'll try to simulate that Chicago experience as much as
and
we
Chicago
can.
And Chicago jazz can't be beat.
No, it cannot be beat.
Well, Ivy Ford is an amazing talent.
Could I add something else about this?
Absolutely.
So this band was specifically requested by a local person, Darcy Mason, and she sponsored this evening for us, which was very special. She has a Darcy Mason Therapy Services, and she really wanted to see Ivy Ford play.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. All right, so it's August already, and how else are you going to swing into summer?
I don't know. I think you're going to swing into summer with Old Sam and the Teardrops, featuring also another dance troupe of Lindy Hop Milwaukee.
Oh, I know that troupe. Okay, they have some amazing dancers.
Oh, yes. This is going to be another. So this is a great bookend. We started with the Salsa Brositas, and now we have Lindy Hop MKE.
So Old Sam and the Teardrops. I'm thinking maybe that's 50s, 60s kind of music?
They're more of a traditional jazz, beginning with the 20s, jug band, blues mix. So a little bit for everyone.
Oh, that should be fun. All right, and then in August 13th, when I saw this title, I kind of was taken aback. Dead on the Square?
Dead on the Square, sure. It's a play on the Grateful Dead because that
oh! Oh, okay. All right. Glad you cleared that up.
And if you didn't figure this out beforehand, because it's very difficult, the band is Deadlick. That's how you pronounce it.
So
they played with us a few years back. It was one of the most popular nights. So we're happy, we're elated to have them back. And watch out, that should be a roaring good time.
We have Tammy Bockhorst here from the Easttown Association. We're talking about the lineup for Jazz in the Park. All right, we're getting to the end of August. And that takes us to August 20th, again, another Thursday night. Sounds like there's going to be some more dancing.
There will be dancing all season long, but you bet on August 20, you better be ready and rested, because we have Platinum, which is hits across the decades, so something for everyone. It's a sing-along night. You'll know the music. Your feet will be tapping and your fingers snapping, so come on down.
All right, and we've only got a couple more left, but you said you're doing a lot of tributes this year. And on August 27th, Real Popular Guy's going to have a tribute.
That's right. We have Billy Joel theme night, so 52nd Street. It's a tribute band of the music of Billy Joel. Billy Joel, I believe, just had his last concert not too long ago.
He was selling out Madison Square Garden every week for years.
Exactly. So hopefully we'll have a packed house that night as well, but it should be a great time.
A tribute to the music of Billy Joel. All right. Now, on September 3rd, so that would be right before Labor Day, I think right before Labor Day, one of the last official Thursdays of the summer, you said this was your suggestion. So, Tammy, I can't wait to hear what this one is.
Oh, boy. Okay. So I hounded the committee, the entertainment committee, and said, I really, really would like a yacht rock themed evening. So we looked, a lot of the bands were packed, were already booked. However, we were fortunate enough to land Whole Yacht of Love. So smooth sailing that evening.
All right. Now, people don't know what yacht rock is. Can you describe it?
Okay. To the best of my knowledge, the best way to look at it is, And by the way, Libby, you probably are aware of this. The genre yacht rock, the term came to play long after the genre occurred. So it's to describe, I'd say, your 70s smooth rock. It's kind of the stuff you can imagine folks sitting listening on their yachts today and singing along. If you had a yacht. And also back when they were rockers. So people a little older who are thinking about their youth, it's phenomenal. A lot of fun. In fact, I was just in Chicago for two different concerts for the Yachtly Crew. We'll maybe bring them next year. They're a national band. And also saw them in Vegas last year.
Well, you certainly have filled a number of genres, and you are going all out on September 10th. Now, this is a brave choice for the Easttown Association. Who's going to be playing on that final Thursday Jazz in the Park?
September 10th, we have Goth Barge, and we are breaking from tradition in a variety of ways that evening. So this is a
Our producer, Isaac, by the way, is really excited about this.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, he is.
We have received a lot of positive feedback, a lot of startled folks as well. But hey, we're super excited about this. So Goth Barge, you had mentioned before, all live performances. This evening is a break from tradition in a variety of ways, including we will have a lot of, this will be DJ music as well. We have DJs coming up from Chicago and all over. There will be interspersed live acts, potentially, but this is...
So it's a little bit of everything.
It's a little bit of everything, and I'm taking a big risk this time. So, but why not end with a big bang?
It sounds like it will be. Well, that's not all that goes on at Jazz in the Park. There's a couple of new surprises this year, and Tammy will share that with us and also give us a little preview of Bastille Days, because that's not that far in the future either. It's all ahead on What's on Tap on WTMJ. 6:42 is our time right now. We have 67 degrees. It's going to get down to 50 overnight.
Welcome back to What's on Tap on WTMJ.
There's a little yacht rock for you. Steely Dan, 6:45 on WTMJ. I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy. On What's on Tap, we're here with Tammy Bockhorst from the Easttown Association. Oh, how could we have forgotten that August 6th date? And I don't know, were you planning on this to be a surprise? Old Sam and the Teardrops. I was wondering who Old Sam is, but there's somebody that people know that's part of that band.
Yes, so our own Milwaukee's own John Sparrow from the Violent Femmes is in that band. So this should be an exciting night.
Oh, mark that one on your calendar. Yes. That's August 6th, swing into summer. Okay. All right. So we've got the whole lineup then, the 12 shows coming up this summer. But there's something new happening at Jazz in the Park. You've brought another element to it that should be a lot of fun for people.
All right. Thank you. So we are moving our popular Cathedral Square Market from Sundays over to 3 p.m. on Thursdays, leading into Jazz in the Park, and many of the vendors are staying the entire night.
Oh, that's going to be fantastic, because there's a lot, at the market, they have a lot of good things to eat.
There's a lot of great eats, lots of treats, lots of things to look at, buy, interactive, you name it. You want a massage, you might get one.
Right up my alley. All right, so it all begins on June 4th at what time?
At 6, the market's at 3, the music begins at 6.
And then 12 weeks of fabulous entertainment at Cathedral Square. But that's not all the East Town Association does, because there's another big event that you're associated with, and we got to mention that.
All right, I appreciate that. So one of the reasons there's a major gap here in July, the first 3 weeks, is because we have Bastille Days coming back.
Eiffel Tower is going to go back up in Cathedral Square.
You know what? That Eiffel Tower got a big makeover this year.
Did it?
Some surgery. And yes, that Eiffel Tower is coming back 100%. We're really excited.
So creps and can-can dancers and all my favorite things are going to be there. And what are the dates of Bastille
Days? Begins on July 9th through the 12th. And Storm the Bastille, the run, the 5K downtown Milwaukee run, is 9 p.m. on July 9th as well, opening night.
And it's celebrating its what
Our
anniversary?
40th anniversary of Storm the Bastille. Yes, we have a record number of registrants already, and we're anticipating beating our last year record-breaking number.
I bet you are. Well, it is going to be a fabulous summer at Cathedral Square, sponsored by East Town Association. Tammy Bockhorst, we can't thank you enough for being here with us tonight.
Thank you so much, Libby. It's been my pleasure. I'm so excited for the season.
And so are we. Well, coming up in just a couple minutes, it's the song you need to hear right here on What's on Tap on WTMJ. This is your shot to get into the best golf outing of the season. WTMJ is sending you and three friends to the WTMJ Classic Golf Outing presented by Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. It's June 30th at Morningstar Golfers Club in Waukesha. A foursome on us. Just head to WTMJ.com and get entered right now. You've got through Friday, June 1st, to do it. Step up, take your swing, and we'll see you on the course.
And now, feast your ears. This is the song you need to hear.
Most blokes going to be playing at 10. These go to 11.
Well, maybe you didn't know it, but the song Respect was originally recorded by Otis Rennig in 1965. But the song that we really remember is Aretha Franklin's iconic cover. It changed the gender of the lyrics, and she introduced that famous spelling of respect. And believe it or not, it was recorded on Valentine's Day of February 14th, 1967. Now, of course, one of the most anticipated acts of the summer at Jazz in the Park is on June 18th, and that's with Long Live the Queen, Respect, a tribute to the Queen of Soul. So, of course, the song you need to hear is from none other than the Queen herself, Aretha Franklin. And that was Aretha Franklin, Respect, way back from 1967. But, you know, it was such a great song, had such complete and total dedication and impact, that the Blues Brothers brought it back in 1980 in their movie. I'm sure you've seen that. Jen Gregg, she's going to be here for news. Have you ever seen the movie Blues Brothers?
Oh, I have not.
You haven't seen it? All right. Well, Isaac, have you seen the Blues Brothers?
Oh, yeah.
And how can you not remember that scene in the cafe on South Side of Chicago with Aretha when her man was going off to join the Blues Brothers?
It's iconic.
And she broke into song. One of my favorite movies and one of my favorite scenes of that movie. All right, we've got a busy show ahead tonight. Coming up right after the news, how much do you think about neon? You know, there was a time in America where neon was everywhere. Every place you looked, you saw neon. And for some people, it's a lost art, but not for everyone. So coming up here after the news, we are going to introduce you to one of Milwaukee's only, I think, neon glass artists. And she has an exhibit coming up that takes neon to a whole new level. And we're going to be hearing about that. And speaking of artists, we're also going to be joined next hour by some participants in the Morning Glory Art Show that happens every year. And this weekend, it's going to be right in the outdoor area around the Marcus Center Performing Arts. And you're going to love that. That is one of my favorite art shows of the year. And also coming up tonight, we're going to be talking with a woman who's written an intriguing name for a book. Now, she spent a number of years as a producer for a lot of shows, including Entertainment Tonight. She worked with Regis Philbin and Kathy Lee Gifford. And she also worked with Robin Leach on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And she has written a book, Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. And she spills it all. And we're going to be talking with her a little bit later on this evening on What's on Tap, right here on WTMJ.
Your need-to-know cultural snapshot of Wisconsin and beyond. This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max. Sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. A deep dive into all things intriguing, riveting, and entertaining. Now, here's your host, Sandy Max.
Sandy's on vacation. I'm Libby Collins in for her. And What's on Tap is sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. Handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org. Well, if you have not been following us along on YouTube or on the WTMJ stream, you'll want to do it right now because we are going to be sharing some amazing photographs with you that are of art that our next guest has created. And she is certainly a unique artist. Her name is Rosalie Phillips. Now, she's a product design engineer who holds an undergrad degree from MIT in engineering, and she has a minor in art and design. But what is even more fascinating is Rosalie bends glass into miniature neon figures. Wait until you see these. Like I said, go to either YouTube or go to WTMJ.com and follow along on the stream because we're going to be posting some of those pictures. But Rosalie, good evening.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Now, how did you go from being a product design engineer to bending glass into neon artwork?
Funny enough, they actually kind of happened around the same time. So it was right after I graduated from college, actually. I graduated right in the midst of COVID. And COVID kind of removed for me some of the things I loved the most about engineering, which was making things in person, right? Like actually going into a lab and a shop and making things. So when I graduated, I was looking for something that would let me be hands-on again. And my sister told me that she had heard of someone nearby her in San Diego, California, who basically he lets you live in his house. So I stayed with him for a week and he taught me how to bend neon in his garage. So I stayed with his family and he taught me all the basics of neon.
So this was an immersive experience.
For sure. So I stayed with him that whole week. He taught me all the basics that I needed to know. And by the end of it, I had my first neon sign. It said Howdy. And I still have it to this day.
But what is it that makes it such a challenging form of art? Because as I said, there was a time in our country where everything was neon. You don't see it very much anymore.
Yeah, well, it is truly a trade. And glass is incredibly finicky. So you heat it the wrong way, it cracks. You cool it the wrong way, it cracks. You bend it a little too tight, it shatters. So the biggest thing is learning how to work with the glass instead of against it. And it takes a long time to really get a feel for how much heat will make things move smoothly, how much cooling in between bends makes things look smooth. So there's just a lot of trial and error and practice that goes into it. It used to be something that was truly like taught in trade schools, and there were full factory floors full of people bending signs. Most every open sign that you see on the street was hand bent by someone. And kind of since the takeover of LEDs, there's less of that, but it is a full trade. So people have dedicated their full lives to bending neon. And I've been doing it for about 5 years, but I'd like to think I'm getting good at it. So
okay, what is the technique that you use? I mean, you say bending glass.
Yeah.
I tried to bend glass once and it broke. But but how do you do that? I mean, and you're talking about tubes that are minuscule.
Yeah. In my case, I've been very small glass. So it's much smaller than what you would see in a normal commercial sign. But yeah, it's kind of what you're talking about. You start with a straight tube of glass and you heat it over just a fire of natural gas and air. It's a softer glass than, say, what like a beaker or like your drinking glass is made out of. You bend it into whatever shape you're looking to make it, which I'm simplifying a lot there. But after that, you put on what are called electrodes at the end, and then you fill it with a small amount of neon gas. That's what creates the glow once you seal off the tube.
What creates the color?
So the color is created by a couple different things. The first one would be what gas you're putting inside of it. So if you put, when you think of like a no vacancy sign, like bright red, that is actually filled with neon gas. So that's what's creating the color, is when you basically put electricity, high voltage and low current through that gas, you're what's called ionizing the gas, and it excites it in a way that makes that glow. But you can fill also a neon sign with argon. You can fill it with krypton, xenon, any noble gas. Argon and neon are the most popular. And then the other things that make color are the phosphors that might be inside the tube. So UV light is given off by certain noble gases mixed with mercury, and that creates different colors, as well as different, actually, like yellow glass will create a yellow color, right? So I use a mix of all three of those in my work. So a different color from the inside and then other colors from the outside, kind of.
Are there can almost any color be created in neon?
Yes and no. You can hand pull your own tubing. So you can truly custom create any color you want, but there's somewhat of a set palette of things that are like, say, the mass manufactured tubes. But you can kind of pick and choose here. You can coat tubes with your own phosphors, which is something that I do in the show. So you can make your own colors that way by mixing your own custom phosphors. And then different colors in different tubes produce different results. So the same yellow tube that I use in the show will create both orange and yellow and green, depending on what gas I put inside of it and depending on what phosphor is lining the tube. So there's some walls with it, but kind of with any art form, you can really like pick and tease at it and create your own palette from it.
We're talking with Rosalie Phillips. She is a neon glass artist, and she has an exhibit. You mentioned a show, and I want to get into that and find out. So, and plus, if you want to take a look at some of the artwork that Rosalie has created, we are airing that on our stream. So you can take a look at that, and boy, wait until you see some of these pieces. And then we're going to tell you how small they really are. It's 713 and 65 degrees at WTMJ.
This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max.
There's a reason Rosalie Phillips, who's our neon artist, said, play that a little bit more. What's the name of this song?
It's called Thunderstorms and Neon Signs.
It's the only song we could find that mentioned neon signs.
Yeah, it's a classic in the neon community, I'd say.
Sounds like an oldie but a goodie. All right, we've got Rosalie Phillips here, and we're talking about her artwork, which is all done in neon. Now, your inspiration comes from your childhood.
Yeah, it's a mixture of moments, I'd say, from my childhood, as well as I've been encouraged, I guess, at different points in my life to journal. And I think I've always found journaling to feel very tedious. So I started doing, I'd say, more visual, like doodle journaling, I'd say, instead. So a lot
what do
of
mean
these
doodle journaling.
So instead of like writing down, I guess, how I'm feeling or the emotions I'm trying to work through or the situation that I'm trying to, I guess, size up for myself, I'll draw, say, a figure going through what's happening, or some kind of series of objects or things that I feel like is encapsulating the situation. And I find that I can often get it down faster than if I were writing it all out. And I've used that as kind of a well of things to draw on in neon, especially with this work where I'm very much creating figures out of neon, right? I'm very much creating gestures and emotions by having these people, but these faceless people, these like shapeless kind of in some ways figures. So I use that combination of kind of these memories and these emotions that I've tried to put on paper And I bend all of these without a pattern, actually, which is unusual for neon.
So you're freestyling, basically.
I am, yeah, which is because with these 3D shapes, it's very hard. Traditional neon, you really are bending against a table. So you want the front of the sign to be flat. So you bend all of it to be flat against the table. When you start getting into this 3D, how do you have the pattern, right? That was very... and I found it almost freeing to start working away from the pattern, to kind of trust that I would be able to figure something out. And being able to use this similar like motif and figure throughout it has really made me, I guess I get very comfortable with it, and I'm able to push more the three-dimensional space of it, which is a really fun aspect of neon that I don't think I touched for the first 4 or so years while I was just trying not to have the glass break.
All right, so the colors that you use in this artwork,
yeah,
is that conveying your mood as well?
Yeah, for sure. I think that I both what I'm talking about of like this these drawings and everything, the other big expression from it is like the light that it's producing, right? And I think almost of these moods or these situations, and I try and distill them down to both the gesture of the moment, but as well as the color. And colors are very emotional to me. So I guess when I'm picking and choosing the color that I think should go with a certain memory, a certain moment, I'm it's all very feelings based, I guess. It's kind of a very therapeutic exercise for me. I'm thinking of what does this moment feel like? What is this emotion? What do these colors make me feel like? And I try and distill that into my work as well, because you've got kind of in neon the shape of the line and the color. Those are your big two avenues. So
well, you think of neon signs as being huge.
Yeah.
They filled up a side of a building. But you're working with small art pieces. Give us an idea of the dimensions that you're working with.
Yeah. So I'm working with glass that's much smaller than normal commercial use. So the diameter of the tube I'm starting with is 6 millimeters, so about a little under a quarter of an inch. And the pieces that I'm ending up with are about like maybe max 10 inches tall and maybe 3 to 6 inches wide, depending on how many figures I'm including. All of them fit inside of these 14 by 14 cubes that I'm using to display them in the show. So it's a very, very small compared to what you would imagine. Even the smallest beer sign you can probably think of, it's smaller than that. So.
And what are they images of?
So they're figures. People... I've had people before call them like you can kind of think of almost like the bathroom sign figure, like the bathroom little man that's in front telling you where the bathroom is, going on different adventures. So I distilled down what I'd say is like the most basic representation of a person, of a figure. There's no face. There's really not like clothing or a ton of maybe even overall shape, but they're in gestures. You know, this is really trying to capture, say, the gestures and moments of home life, especially in this show. So they are a little two-dimensional figures pushed into three dimensions, I would say.
When you're working with a glass, I mean, inevitably, something has to break.
Oh, all the time.
When that happens, can you reuse it? Or is it, well, that one's out the window?
It depends on how badly you break it. So I will say, preparing for the show, I did step on one of the pieces, and that shattered to the point where you can't reuse that. So if it cracks, like if it breaks in two, sometimes you can heat it and weld it back together.
Like a clean crack.
Yeah, if it's a clean crack, you can often fix that. When it shatters, it's very hard to put shattered pieces back together. But it's not to say that you can't.
Kind of like life.
Exactly. It's so true. But you can, say, reuse the part that's not shattered. So that's another thing that I love about neon in general, and the trade and the craft of neon, is that neon is repairable. It's somewhat infinitely repairable. Pieces that are from like the 1920s are still being repaired and maintained and are still glowing today, which is not necessarily the same for, I guess, other types of lighting. So it's one of the things that I love. There's a lot of culture of reuse and repair and maintenance in neon that is really beautiful.
We're talking with Rosalie Phillips. Now, she has an exhibit going on, and as she said, a show, and we're going to tell you where it is, when you can see some of her artwork, and I believe some of it's for purchase, too.
Yeah.
We'll find out about it right after this on What's on Tap on WTMJ.
What's on Tap with Sandy Max is back on WTMJ.
There's a neon light.
Libby Collins here with Neon artist Rosalie Phillips. And Rosalie, we mentioned that there is an exhibit going on. You've only been doing this art for 5 years, you said?
Yeah, for
5 years.
Is this
your first exhibition?
This is my first chance to put on like a solo installation, which I'm extremely excited about.
Describe this to us.
Yeah, so the concept of the show kind of is these small figures, I guess, living in community with each other, but in isolation. So if you can imagine, it's kind of, I've created more or less like a high-rise apartment building for these figures, and they all live in their own little boxes, little dollhouse boxes inside of there. So when you come to the exhibit, there's this large sort of standing tower of neon, but I've somehow, I guess, managed to try and make it look very grand while having each of the neon pieces be very small inside of it. And it's sort of meant to talk about and represent the home life of these different figures. And they're living their isolated lives, but also all in community with each other together, which can often feel, I guess, how, say, like moving to a new city can potentially feel. If you're inside of an apartment building, you live in your unit, you're kind of isolated, but you know at the same time you're living with all of these other people who are in community with you. So it's a bit of a conversation about that as
how,
well.
How many pieces are on display?
There's 18 total pieces. It's a lot of neon.
I was going to say, where is this? Where can you go and see this? Because this is being displayed until August?
August 2nd, yes. So it is at River Press in River West. It's on Humboldt, actually. It's actually a really cute store.
It's not a very big store, is it?
No, it's actually inside of one of the old River, like an old River West house, basically, on the bottom floor. It's run by an awesome artist named Maya, and she basically uses it as a place to not only display Milwaukee artists' work, but also she only sells the art of Milwaukee artists. I've heard like she's even say people from Racine, she's like, that's too far away. She calls it incredibly local is what she advertises it kind of.
Racine is too far.
Racine is
How
too
about
far.
Tosa? No.
I don't know where the line is, but apparently Racine is too far. It's over the line.
All right. So if you're interested in coming, are there certain hours to come and see this?
Or? Yeah. So the shop is open Thursday through Sunday. I believe the hours are something around like 1 to 7, though I think it fluctuates a little bit. They're all on the website. I think their website is riverpressmke.com. Come by, check it out. The later you go in the day, I will say, the nicer it looks.
But are these for sale?
Yes, each piece is for sale. That was actually another goal of mine with this show, is to try and create neon that felt approachable for the home. So I think when people think also about neon signs, they think of like a beer sign, say, or something on the outside of a building. But the goal, additionally, with these pieces and with the scale, is to have something that felt approachable to incorporate neon into people's lives and into people's homes. So something you could put on the shelf, something you could have on your bookcase that gave beautiful like light and color to your home, some emotion, some story to your home without it feeling like you have a beer sign in your house, I guess. So
did you art commissions as well?
Yes, I do. So I've made a couple. I do both sort of business style commissions, and I also do just custom art commissions. So I've had people say everything from they have a pretty concrete idea of what they want to I would like something with phones involved in it, and then let me kind of riff off of that. I love doing both. So my website is neonsignsfromtheuniverse.com. You can contact me through there. It's the same Neon Signs from the Universe on all my socials. Reach out and we can always chat about it.
Last question.
Yeah.
You graduated from MIT in engineering.
Yes.
Are you planning on giving that up to become a full-time neon artist? And I'm sure your mother's asked you the same question.
I know, if my mom's listening. I don't know. We'll see where it takes me. I think right now I do love both. I think my goal would be one day to potentially be able to do this full-time. So each show that I do and each commission that I get is really meaningful to me because it's tracking towards maybe getting to do that with my career. Though if my mom was listening, I would tell her that it also involves engineering. There's a lot of construction of things. A lot of the things that I use, I did learn at engineering school. So I'm not giving up engineering. But I would love to be able to do it full time someday. And hopefully the show is sort of a stepping stone towards that.
Rosalie Phillips, your delight. I hope to talk to you again real soon.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Welcome back to What's on Tap on WTMJ.
Welcome back to What's on Tap. I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy Max. Oh boy, we've got the art. We've got art galore tonight. And again, if you have not been watching us on YouTube or on WTMJ.com, you definitely have to, because we have some amazing art and artists here in the studio. I mentioned a little earlier that this weekend is the date for the 2026 Morning Glory Art Fair. This is one of the biggest and best art fairs, I think, in the state of Wisconsin. And joining us are Sarah Way. She is with Wisconsin Craft, and they have sponsored the Morning Glory Art Fair now for, well, I don't know. It's been a long time. I don't want to give the wrong number of years. She's with us along with Chris Jensen, who is a nationally award-winning jewelry designer. And I'm telling you, you're not going to get out of this studio, Chris, with all of that jewelry. And also, we've got Pull Tab Matt here. Pull Tab Matt. Well, we're going to tell you about Pull Tab Matt in just a minute. But first of all, good evening to everybody.
Good evening.
Hello.
So, Sarah, how many years has it been for Morning Glory?
This will be our 51st annual Morning Glory Art Fair. So, yeah, last year was our 50th, and we said we couldn't stop there. We had to keep going. 51st.
51 years.
Yeah.
So it's a big one for you. Now, yeah. As far as Morning Glory is concerned, in 51 years, I know you get better and bigger every single year, and you're back to another location where you used to be.
Yeah. So this year is great. So what's happening at Morning Glory this year is we obviously have our amazing artists that are all around the states, as the Midwest and even farther. I think there's about 120 or so. So there's an endless array there. And we also have food trucks. And then also this year, we've included some mini workshops. So registration is closed for those, but we invite the community to kind of like watch artists as they create and have a hands-on experience. But yeah, what's bigger and better? I mean, the change. So we changed our location and we changed our date. We used to be at the Pfizer Forum. We are now at the Marcus Center. We are so excited to be connected with an arts-centered, like, focused organization in downtown Milwaukee. And then we also changed our date. So we used to be at mid-August, and now we're at the end of May. Technically, we are the weekend after Memorial Day, so y'all don't have to be worried about, like, deciding to go to the art fair. Or if you want to, like, spend time with your family, that will not be a conflict in future years. So we're always going to be the weekend after Memorial Day.
All right. So now you're an artist.
Yes.
So
me, I'm not participating in the art because I'm actually right now I'm the role of the marketing director. So I will be on site kind of helping. I'll be doing socials. I have an intern with me. My own personal art, I do more wearable art when I have time. Time is not a lot these days, but when I have a chance, I'll kind of sew hats, mittens, scarves. And kind of play on the sewing machine.
Is this a juried show?
This is a juried show, yeah. So all artists have to apply. They go through a blind jury process. So when jurors look at images, they are not aware of anything but the art and the booth display. And they're picked based on the quality of the art and also the variety. So we got a lot going on.
Well, we got to talk about some of the art. And I mentioned Chris Jensen a few minutes ago. And Chris is from here in Milwaukee. As a matter of fact, you've got a jewelry store in South Milwaukee.
Correct.
And you do all custom fine jewelry, and we've got some of that on camera right now. How long have you been doing this, Chris?
I've been doing jewelry for about 25 years, a little over 25 years, and in those 25 years, I have over 30 design awards under my belt. So I'm quite proud of the workmanship that we do at my store.
How would you describe the jewelry you create?
We are still doing like all the old world hand-done techniques. We do our own casting, our own wax carving, our own stone setting. Everything is done right there in my jewelry store from start to finish. And like many artists and things, it's becoming a lost art. So many things are being mass produced. And here we make one-of-a-kind, unique heirloom pieces that last a lifetime.
I love that you say heirloom. We're going to hear more about that. And also we're going to introduce you to Pull Tab Matt. Can't wait for you to meet him. It's all ahead on What's on Tap on WTMJ, 740 and 52 degrees at WTMJ.
You're listening to What's on Tap with Sandy Max on WTMJ.
And I'm Libby, in for Sandy tonight, and we are talking with artists from the Morning Glory Art Fair. We have Sarah Way here along with Chris Jensen and Pull Tab Matt. You're going to meet him in just a minute. I got to talk more here too, Chris, though, because this jewelry, you have it. And if you're looking at our stream or at YouTube, you can see this. Can you describe these pieces, beginning with the necklace on the right, Chris?
Sure. The one that's up there in the silver, it's got the white crystal and the green stone up above. That crystal shard was actually dug up in Arkansas by my kids.
What?
We took them crystal hunting. My husband and I have four kids. We went down to Arkansas, dug around in the dirt, and they actually found that crystal shard. And then I made the pendant out of it. And so it has the date actually in there of 3/2022. That was when it was found.
I have been to Arkansas. I haven't seen anything like that.
Oh, it's so much fun. You can go there and you can find all kinds of quartz crystals and stuff at the mines. They let you dig around. It's wonderful fun.
Now, what about the next one to the immediate left?
The next one there is a selenite that's in the main stone. That's the white crystal. And then there's various colored green tourmalines that are set in that one. And that's one of my national award winners. And that one actually qualified to go into an international competition, and I would have gone to Hong Kong, but then COVID hit.
Oh, my.
And so since then, they've never redone that show again, but I was qualified for an international award for that one if it would have happened.
It's just absolutely stunning. And then you have a couple of bracelets, and I'm eyeballing those right now.
The two bracelets, one is in the grape leaf design, and that is done by casting individual leaves, setting all the stones, and then assembling the piece all together. And then the other one is done in sterling silver. And that one there, all those pieces of jasper, I hand cut one by one and inlay them like puzzle pieces in order to fill up the entire design.
How long does it take you to create a piece of jewelry like that?
We normally say for our clients that we need at least 6 to 8 weeks start to finish from the whole design to the finish concept. Some pieces like the bracelet with the inlaid stones, that's about 1 week of 40 hours solid, maybe a week and a half, just to cut the stones for that. And the green tourmaline bracelet and the grape leaves, that was a year in process.
What inspires you? Is it the piece of stone that you begin with? And do you envision it from the beginning? Or is it working along and then creating something as you go?
Every which way. We do so many custom orders at the store for people. My design tastes are very eclectic. One day I feel like something big and chunky. The next day something's delicate and filigree. So it really allows me to cooperate with other people to get their designs. Sometimes a stone just strikes me right and I have an idea right away. Other times we just play around and I have so many sketches that I'll never get everything rendered in my lifetime.
Do you put them on paper first?
Yes. Yep, we do everything for when we're working on a custom order. I sketch it out in color to scale, and that way you could actually like hold the drawing up or you could put it on your hand to get an idea of what it will look like. But a lot of people, it's hard to make that leap. So we actually carve every piece in a wax model, and you can actually come in and see that form before we commit to the metal casting itself. And that allows us to tweak it, change it a little bit if we need to, make adjustments. But it's such a fun process to be able to see it every step along the way.
I'm sure you've heard this question a lot lately. The price of precious metals has skyrocketed.
Highest it's ever been.
I mean, I look at the price and I'm in awe, mm-hmm. thinking about what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. How has that affected you and the work you do?
The nice thing is since we make everything ourselves, our labor cost has not gone up like the metal market has. So while items have gotten a little bit pricier, we're still way more competitive than anything where somebody has to buy it, mark it up, and resell it anyways. And we've been busier than ever.
So, do you have clients bring stones to you?
They bring stones. They bring ideas. Sometimes they bring in stuff they've inherited and we rework it into the things. So I like to say we do engagement jewelry, divorce jewelry, inherited this ugly
Wait,
thing. Can you make it better
jewelry? There's such a thing?
Oh, absolutely. You know, sometimes you want a happy result out of an unhappy circumstance. We're here to make it happen.
Well, you're absolutely amazing, Anna. And if you're just looking at this jewelry on camera, you have to see it in person to really appreciate the craftsmanship. And of course, you can see it this weekend at the Morning Glory Art Fair, which is taking place at the Marcus Performing Arts Center on Saturday and Sunday. We're going to tell you more about that. But coming up here in just a couple minutes, you're going to meet a man who goes by the name Pull Tab Matt. How did he get that name? What is it he does? We'll find out right after this on What's on Tap.
This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk.
As our producer Isaac Marquardt says, pull tabs are gambling. I don't know. I never gambled with pull tabs, but I bet our next artist has, and that's Pull Tab Matt. What a great name for an artist from Wisconsin. We've got Matthew Cross here. He's from Sheboygan. And wait until you see his art. And if you're watching us on YouTube or on the WTMJ.com live stream, you can see it. Matt, first of all, pull tabs. Why do they call you that?
Well, because I make art out of them. I mean, it's as simple as that. I started doing this style of art about 5 years ago, and someone said it one time, it kind of stuck at all the bars in Sheboygan, and now when I walk into a bar, it's, pull tab Matt's here. I'm like, oh man, I just came for a beer by myself so I can zone out for a while, and now everybody's talking to me. What are you working on? What's the next upcoming show? So,
what inspired you? I mean, you didn't grow up thinking someday I'll make art out of pull tabs.
Correct.
Or did you?
No, I did not. I did a ton of art back in high school and kind of picked it back up about 6 years ago, right before COVID, and then it just kind of launched into it. But there's a lot of artists that do mixed media pixel art, whether it's dice or Rubik's Cubes. And as an artist, I know how expensive cost of goods can be. So I tried to find one that I didn't have to pay for. So I take people's losers. So really all I'm paying for is the glue, the framing, the paint, and then, you know, about 80 hours of work to do a piece like that.
So your very first time you decided to create pull tab art, where did you begin? I mean, did you just go to your favorite bar and get pull tabs? Or
yeah.
How did that work?
Yeah, it was a fish fry at Friday night. I remember asking them. It's four of a kind in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. That was one of them. Bumps in Sheboygan, and then that place on A Street were the first three. And first person I asked looked at me, I was crazy. I was like, trust me, I got an idea. And I wanted to do a topographic map of Wisconsin that ended up being about 3.5 feet by 3.5 feet.
Well, you have big pieces. The one that's on camera right now, am I wrong? Is that the state of Michigan?
No, that's Wisconsin.
That's Wisconsin? Why does it have an M in it?
For Milwaukee?
Oh, I was going to say, is it upside down? Should that be a W?
No, it's a brick city. Those are bricks. It's the Brewers logo.
Okay.
And then I extended the bricks into the background.
Ah, I see. Okay,
see it now?
Now I'm getting it. Because the M in the middle and the fact that it's blue and gold kind of threw me. I was thinking, is this Michigan shaped in the form of Wisconsin?
Well, you got to talk to Brewers about their logo then and change it up if you're thinking that.
All right, so let's talk about that. How long does it take you to create a piece like that?
From start to finish, usually about this size, specifically about 80 hours.
And how do you even begin? I mean, do you visualize it first? Do you put it on paper?
Digital. So I digitize and pixelate the image into, let's say, light blue, dark blue, and gold for this one specifically. And then I pick images off of losing pull tabs that I have, like whatever I have the most light blue of, that's what I pull for it.
What color do pull tabs come in?
Everything now. Because I have a good supply of people that give them to me, I'll tell you that.
Is it just in Wisconsin, or do you get pull tabs from all over the country?
I only get them from Wisconsin. It's legal in about 28 states or so. Wisconsin's the second biggest, right next to Minnesota.
So this is truly Wisconsin-based art.
Correct.
And it's all, I mean, even what you're working with.
Yes.
Made everything. And manufactured here in Wisconsin.
And people played those and lost.
Do you ever think of yourself as a losing artist?
No, I don't think so.
Well, you're working with losing pull tabs.
I call it upcycling.
Now, you've got other art. How many pieces are you going to be displaying at the Morning Glory Art Fair?
Honestly, I was packing the trailer today and I haven't even decided, and it's already this weekend. So I'm thinking at least a dozen I'll have about this size.
Are they all? Well, that's what I was going to say. So the dimension of that, if you're watching on camera, is what, about 3x3?
A little smaller than that, closer to about 2.5 feet. I don't remember exactly.
And
what
are some of the largest pieces you do?
Well, the largest piece I ever did was a 4x6 piece, and that was a portrait of Vince Lombardi.
So you go out of your way to find Wisconsin-themed ideas. So in addition to the state of Wisconsin, with a big M on it, which confused me, and Vince Lombardi, what are some of the other pieces you've created?
So I have another one here. I could pull it up quick. A lot of people ask me who inspires me, and it's not always a visual artist. David Bowie.
Oh, he's not from Wisconsin.
He's not from
Wisconsin. I need you on mic, though. You need to tell me on mic. Okay,
I'll tell you.
So David Bowie.
David Bowie.
But not from Wisconsin.
He's not from Wisconsin, but he is an artist that decided that he wanted to do his own thing, and he has a lot of interviews that really inspire me about how to just get your feet just enough above the sand, but not to where you're drowning, and that's when you're going to start creating something really special.
Well, the colors in this are quite vibrant.
Yes.
And again, did you start out saying, I'm going to make a portrait of David Bowie?
Yes.
And you worked it out how?
And so I mapped it out. I found kind of that, iconic lightning bolt down the face image, and then I just pixelated it myself to the size where I always start with the smallest thing first. So I started with the nostril, the one dot, and then I built the nose, and then I built the eyes in proportion, and then it portions out. Sometimes it works out where I can actually make a piece. Sometimes I've started one and it portions out to 6 foot by 6 foot. And I'm like, nah, I'm not going to do that one today.
And then do you reuse those pull tabs?
So I don't actually glue anything down until I already know that what the size is going to be.
So if you don't like it, it's just back to the drawing board.
Yep. I have probably about 20 or 30 designs that I've done that I haven't built, whether it was because I don't have the time or the energy, or it's just not going to fit onto a board that I can put in my trailer.
We're talking with Matthew Pull Tab Matt Kraus. He's from Sheboygan. He's an artist from there. We also have Chris Larson here with us, or Chris Jensen, rather, with us, who is a nationally award-winning jewelry designer and owner of C3 Designs in South Milwaukee. And Sarah Way from Morning Glory, and it's the art fair happening this weekend. We're going to tell you more about it right after the news with Jen Gregg on WTMJ.
Your need-to-know cultural snapshot of Wisconsin and beyond. This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max, sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. A deep dive into all things intriguing, riveting, and entertaining. Now, here's your host, Sandy Max.
And What's on Tap is sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. Handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org. I'm Libby Collins. It's our final hour for What's on Tap, and we are still here with our folks from the Morning Glory Art Fair, one of the finest art fairs in, I think, the entire country. And we've got Sarah Way here, Chris Jensen, who is a jewelry artist, and also Matthew Pulltab Matt Kraus from Sheboygan, whose art primarily is really Wisconsin-oriented. Sarah, let's talk a little bit more about the Morning Glory Art Fair. You said new location this year.
Yes. Yep. We're at the Marcus Center, so we're really excited to be downtown in like the arts district. And then the new dates as well. So we're at the weekend, this weekend, May 30th and 31st. We're around from 10 to 5 on both days. I encourage you to stop by earlier than 5, get there around noon, so you're going to have a time to walk around and see all 120 plus artists. And have a good time.
Well, you said 120 artists. Now, obviously, we've talked to Chris and Matt, and mm-hmm. we know that they are doing some very unique pieces. But what other artists are you going to have? What other kinds of art will people be able to see?
Yeah, so other mediums that we have are ceramics, which are your functional art. We have fiber artists. We have photographers, digital art. Jewelry is always a big hit, as well as mixed media. So, yeah, we have a wide range of artists that will be attending, so I'm sure you'll find something that you want.
Why do people want to come to an art fair? What do you hear from people when they come in?
Yeah, from my artist experience, I love to be engaging with the art, and not only the art, but the people who make the art. You don't get that same engagement if you're on a website, you're on social media, but I get to hear the stories directly from you guys. I get to hear your process. I get to feel your emotion and your passion behind your work. And personally, that's what drives me as a marketing director to like support the arts community within Wisconsin.
And of course, we have two of the artists here, Chris and Matt. Why do you enjoy being at an art fair, Chris?
You get to connect with a whole diverse group of people that don't necessarily, you know, like for me, since we have the store, we have people that come in there, but being at an art fair different than our normal location, you get to come into contact with a wide variety of new people.
And how about you, Matt?
I really like showing my process. A lot of people ask me, you know, how do you start? Where does it begin? And I have a bunch of stuff here, you know, kind of all the supplies, where it all comes from. And I can explain, you know, what it is in case they think it's a Michigan piece and it's really a Milwaukee piece. but I just really like showing the process because they say, they're like, that's so cool. But when they see what it takes to produce all of my art, I really like seeing that wow factor of like, you're crazy. And I'm like, I know, it's okay.
Or the person looking at it is crazy because they think it's Michigan when it's really Wisconsin. All right, I was never good at geography. So Matt, what's the most
unusual remark you have ever gotten from somebody, like at an art fair or whatever, when they've seen this art? And obviously, it is unique. I have never seen pull tab art before.
Mm-hmm.
What do they say to you?
One woman told me she was about to pass out because she couldn't look at it anymore. That was probably the most unique one that I've ever heard.
It is sort of an eye test.
Yeah. And I start seeing spots after a few hours of gluing, let me tell you. Most people just say, wow. And that's really what I go for, is just the wow factor. It's something my old mentor told me to do whenever I was working on stuff. So that's really what the impression I'm going for is.
And what's the favorite piece you've ever created?
Favorite piece I ever created? So I did a Pac-Man one where under black light, it's kind of a before and after. So it's before Pac-Man's going to eat the pip. It's Miss Pac-Man, but going to eat the pill so that the ghosts turn blue. The after effect, when you turn off all the lights and put black light on it, it's after that, 2 seconds later, eats one of the ghosts, turns into 200. The eyes start going back to the center. The ghosts are now running away with the eyes facing a different direction. And there is no paint on that at all. Pull tabs have a glow-in-the-dark feature to them that I found that some companies do and some companies don't. And I was able to create it. So if you're there, I will have a black light and I will show you what it looks like.
That really sounds amazing. I'd come to the art fair just to see that. And Chris, I want to ask you too. Chris Johnson, the nationally award-winning jewelry designer. Is there a piece that you are, you mentioned this one piece that never made it to the Hong Kong International Art Fair, but is there a piece that really is more significant to you than any other?
The piece that I've actually got around my neck right now is an Australian boulder opal. And one of a dear friend of mine who also, you know, client, of course, she originally picked up the pair of opals as a pair of earrings and they were too big. And so she wanted one made into a pendant and she actually let me have the other one for doing the work for her. And so it's just kind of a nice, you know, I think of her then whenever I'm wearing it.
And it is stunning piece, I must say.
It's the pieces that have that personal connection that are the most important. That's why we have tissues handy at the store, because you never know when, you know, you make that one-of-a-kind piece for somebody and it just brings tears to your eyes.
Oh, well, if you want to meet Chris Johnson, if you want to meet the one and only Pull Tab Matt, and if you want to see 120 artists, it's all happening this weekend. And where is it again, Sarah?
It's at the Marcus Center, downtown Milwaukee.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 till 5. Well, I hope you don't get rained out this year like you did last year.
Oh, no. No. No rain this year. No.
Well, it's the Morning Glory Art Fair. And again, if you enjoy any kind of art fair, this is a, I guess you could say it's a step above all the others. Mm-hmm. I love the artists that you have, and it's absolutely fabulous. Once again, thank you, Sarah Way, Chris Jensen, and the one and only Pull Tab Matt Cross from Sheboygan. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you so much for
having us.
It's 8:13, and coming up next, we are going to hear from a woman who spent years as a producer for TV shows like Regis and Kathy Lee, Entertainment Tonight, and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And she has all of the dirt behind the scenes of all those celebrities and some of the things that they won't say when they're on camera. It's all ahead on What's on Tap on WTMJ. Fran Weinstein is a retired television director, producer, and author who spent over three decades working behind the scenes in entertainment journalism. Now, her career includes working on Entertainment Tonight, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. And she now has written about her life in high heels, low expectations, and the Hollywood gossip mill. Her book is Tortured Souls. What a great title for a book, Fran. I love it.
Thank you so much, Libby.
You know, how old were you when you got into the business of TV?
Actually, I was 30, but I already had a career in print journalism. So I had to redo everything and start all over again as a production assistant. But I was 30 years old and I had some social skills by then.
All right. So you said you had social skills. Why is that important in celebrity journalism?
It's the most important thing because it's about having the skill to engage and connect and sort of take the temperature of a room in less than 2 seconds. You just have to know how to be and how to move around the world.
You know, you write about your ability to read people, and it's almost like you're a little bit of a psychic. Explain how that works and works effectively when you're dealing in something like television, when you're producing a live show like Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. What were your duties at that show?
Well, at Live, I was a booker. I was actually Regis Philbin's very first talent booker when he came to New York, and nobody knew who he was. So I basically sat on the doorstep of people like Joan Rivers, et cetera, and other New York personalities to get them to come on the show and just talk them into it.
What do you mean you sat on their doorstep?
Well, I found out, you know, through this person and that person in this corner store or whatever, where Joan Rivers lived. And I hung at her apartment building hoping to catch her when she came home or when she left. And she knew Regis from Los Angeles. So I did catch her coming home one day, and I talked her into coming on the first week of the show.
And Regis, who you said at the time, nobody knew who he was, turned
into... Nobody knew him in New York City. It was shocking.
Yeah.
It was really shocking because nobody knew about the Joey Bishop show. Yeah. So apparently he had a talk show with Mary Hart called AM Los Angeles, I believe that was the title. And unfortunately, it didn't do well, but... He was phenomenal, and so he was brought to New York to build this brand new morning show, live talk show, which is, as we know now, called Live, simply Live, and it's very successful.
Well, tell us a little bit about Regis. What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, my God, what a doll. Regis was like your favorite uncle. He was warm as toast. He was really every man. He was so relatable. He would tell stories about what he did last night in New York City. He would tell stories about how his mother-in-law annoyed him, how his wife, he couldn't get along with his wife. But, you know, it was all in good humor. And he was so easy. And everybody wanted to hang out with him. In fact, Regis, I became pretty close with Regis. He was at my first wedding. And he told me not to marry my first husband because he didn't think he was for me. So that's how close I was with him. But he was a wonderful, wonderful family-oriented guy who you just crack a joke with and, you know, really have a deep conversation with at the same time.
There was an interesting energy between Regis Philbin and Kathy Lee. How did you maneuver that as a booker for the show?
It's interesting you should ask that because there was really not much to maneuver at that point. They had such an incredibly organic connection, those two. And honestly, I don't think there was ever a talk show team that had what they had, that have to this day what they had. By the time he and Kathy Lee were the headliners of that show was easy to book. By that time, I had built relationships with a lot of publicists, and everybody knew Regis. He took off. He just took off, and that team was so easy. Everybody just wanted to be on the show. It wasn't a difficult show to book at all.
Were there any guests who were difficult that once they got to the studio, you were like, oh, no, how am I going to get them on stage and get them to talk?
Grace Jones, if you remember the name, that name.
She was sort of a disco Studio 54 personality.
Yeah. Exactly. There was a point at which I wasn't sure if she was actually coming because she hadn't arrived at the appointed time. And so we literally had to send a police escort to her. And she was demanding and she wanted this and she wanted that. Another one was Zsa Zsa Gabor, who, may she rest in peace, wanted this, wanted that. It was just out of the ordinary requests. You know, it was almost like the cliche, like they wanted the blue M&Ms taken out of the bowl. But most of the time, the guests were pretty great.
Who was the nicest of the big stars that you booked on Regis's show?
I mean, they were all really, really, really terrific. Really terrific. We were very lucky. Everybody was great. I can't remember, who was the nicest for that show. But I'll tell you who's the nicest star in the universe, and that's George Clooney.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. George Clooney, every time anybody asks me who my favorite celebrity is, I would say George Clooney. He gets the game. He's a huge movie star, but the most down to earth because he loves to have a good time. And he's just easy peasy. In fact, I remember one time we were on the red carpet of the daytime Emmys, and he was, you know, at the height of his stardom. And we were just talking. He was so easy to talk with and loved to laugh and chit-chat. And I was doing just that with him on the carpet. We weren't even, the cameras weren't even rolling anymore. And he turned to me and he said, uh-oh, there's a really big star coming. I better get out of the way. And, I mean, he was the biggest movie star going, so.
Who'd he get out of the way for? Do you remember?
I think it was Mick Jagger, quite frankly.
Well, he is a pretty big star.
He is a big star, but I mean, George, you know, I mean, you weigh that. George Clooney, Mick Jagger, okay, even scale, maybe. But it was just funny that he, you know, I better get out of the way. he knew the game. He knew what you had to do. He knew you had to keep one eye on who was coming, one eye on the star you were talking to, and, of course, the other third eye on the star's handler who was wrapping you up or telling you not to ask a question or something.
I want to find out about that. We are talking with Fran Weinstein. Her book is called Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. It's all here on What's on Tap on WTMJ.
Welcome back to What's on Tap on WTMJ.
We're talking with Fran Weinstein. Her book is called Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. Fran, you mentioned about handling publicists, especially on the red carpet. And when you watch those shows on TV, you see all these glamorous people, and they come over to the velvet rope to talk with the reporters. And it seems so spontaneous. But it's not, is it?
It's anything but spontaneous. First of all, most of these red carpet interviews are pre-negotiated before you even get out to the carpet, that if such and such shows up, they will speak to Entertainment Tonight, and sometimes only Entertainment Tonight. And in the rare instance, the star would show up. We knew who was going to show up to a red carpet, so it wasn't all that spontaneous. But in the rare instance, a star would show up, and just it was the luck of the draw whether he or she would talk to you. But it was really based on relationships. Relationships you have with the star, relationships you have with the publicist.
Who was the most difficult get on the red carpet?
Well, the most difficult get was, if you remember The Sopranos, James Gandolfini. Nobody could get him. Nobody, he just never, ever, ever did an interview. So if you were lucky enough to even get a smile out of him, that was a big deal.
And did you get an interview? Did you ever get an interview with him?
No, never. Never did. He never did it. He never did it with anyone. He was a very, very shy man and just didn't like to do interviews.
Who always seemed to be more than willing to talk to you?
George Clooney. Jamie Lee Curtis, Leonardo DiCaprio, Stanley Tucci is a doll. A living doll. Honestly, the bigger the stars, the better they were. But, you know, again, it takes years of building relationships with these people.
So let's say if one of these celebrities is in something where it just broke that, you know, they're in the middle of a divorce or their spouse was just caught in an affair or maybe there's a movie that's not doing well. How do the publicists approach you on that? When they know that they're going to be on the red carpet and you're going to be looking for an interview, what sort of things do they tell you beforehand?
That's a great question because most of the time, it is also, again, pre-negotiated that you're not to ask about said divorce, said scandal, said affair, et cetera. Don't ask about it. And, you know, that meant that if you dared to do it, they'd be pulled away from you. And sometimes, you know, you'd never get them for another year. You'd be banned. I didn't always play by their rules, I have to say. Sometimes, and it depended, again, on taking the temperature of the room, I took a chance if I really, really felt like this is the number one story that people are talking about in pop culture right now. You can't avoid it. So I took the chance. And sometimes they wrapped it up, and sometimes they didn't.
Oh,
which was
okay.
Lucky.
Well, let's talk about the times that they didn't. Who did you take a chance on and got a really headline-making answer?
Britney Spears, we were told not to ask about that 24-hour marriage that she had. And I went ahead and, of course, asked about it. And she gave me a little something. And even a little something is a huge scoop, right?
Mm-hmm.
and I was the only one to get that. Princess Diana, when she did the red carpet for the Met Gala, I mean, she wasn't even doing any interviews. I screamed a question out, like, how are you enjoying New York City? And she turned and she said, lovely. And that was more than anybody ever got from her. You know, so that was huge. But I was known for that. I really was. Like, I would kind of go the extra mile and sneak a question in. Sarah Jessica Parker was pregnant with her first child, and it was on the red carpet for one of the premieres of Sex and the City seasons. And I did ask her about it, and she did confirm it to me. So that was a huge scoop.
How did you somehow get those questions and get answers? By working around what the publicist had told you before, don't bring this up. Were there ways that you would frame a question?
Yeah, there were. It depended on how well I knew the star and how many times I had worked with the star beforehand. So I had the feeling whether or not they would cooperate. What just came to mind was Robin Williams. May he rest in peace. What a national treasure he was. When Christopher Reeves died, they were best friends, those two. And when Chris Reeves died, I mean, it was just such a tragedy and everyone was mourning. And I was told not to ask, but I knew Robin so well. He was such a genuine spirit. And I said to him, I have to ask you, and I am asking you this with love. What is the feeling to lose your best friend in Chris Reeves? And he gave me a beautiful answer. So sometimes you just have to persist, but you have to do it in a very respectful way.
We're talking with Fran Weinstein. She's written a fabulous book. It's all about her stories of covering celebrities. It's called Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. And there was one big story that a lot of people are still talking about that involved the late Anne Heche. We're going to get to that right after this on What's on Tap on WTMJ.
You're listening to What's on Tap with Sandy Max on WTMJ.
Welcome back. We are talking with Fran Weinstein. Her book is Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. And I have to ask you about this story, Fran. And that is actress Anne Heche, who died so tragically a couple of years ago. You had a very interesting interaction with her. I believe it was when you were working on Entertainment Tonight.
Yes, it was. I was interviewing her. I had interviewed her for the remake of Psycho, and she reunited with Vince Vaughn for the Psycho remake, but she had done Return to Paradise just prior to this film. So she reunited with him in this film, and there were rumors that, you know, they were having an affair, and it was kind of widely publicized. But we talked about the movie, we talked about how much fun it was reuniting with Vince Vaughn. And of course, then, you know, that's sort of the lead in, the way you work your way into an agenda question, as it were. And I said, you know, rumor has it you guys were an item during the filming of Return to Paradise. And oh my God, her jaws dropped to the floor. And she said, oh, I don't want to talk about that. And that's not true. And I said, no problem. We are moving on.
Now, wait a second. Before you move on, though. Wasn't she involved with Ellen DeGeneres at that time?
Yes, they had just begun a committed relationship, those two. And so, you know, I think that that was at the bottom of her upset with my question. And so she was very upset by it. But so I said, moving on, and we're not going to talk more about that. No problem. And she gave me a lot more time, and we talked about her Christmas plans with Ellen, and we wrapped up. And she goes to the door. We said our thank yous and goodbyes. And she said, I don't want you to use that stuff about me and Vince Vaughn. And I said, oh, no problem. I said I wouldn't. You don't have to worry about it. I give you my word. And so she left, and the crew and I were packing up the gear, and a knock at the door comes, and it is the studio publicist. And she said, Fran, Anne would like you to give her the tape. And I said, excuse me? She said, well, she doesn't want you to use that stuff about Vince Vaughn, so just give me the tape and it'll be. And I'm like, no, of course not. I'm not going to give you the tape. I can't do that. I won't do that. She said, okay, whatever. I said, just tell her that I told her I'm not going to use it. It's all good. And then I shut the door, go back to packing up, came back, and And there's another knock at the door. And this time it is her personal publicist. And he said, you need to give me that tape because Anne doesn't want you. I said, I do not need to give you the tape. And I'm not going to give you the tape. And he said, if you don't give me the tape, you'll never get another interview with her again. And I said, I don't care. It's a precedent that I'm not going to set right now. It's very dangerous to do something like that. He closes the door. Now we're all packed up and we go to the elevators, and the elevator's doors open, and out from the elevators lunges Anne Heche. And she had this scowl on her face, and I whacked my finger in her face and I said, you're not getting the tape. And this started a whole situation of screaming and yelling, you don't respect me, you don't respect my girlfriend. And I said, no, no, I do respect your girlfriend. And all this back and forth, and she was yelling at me. And I said, look, let's take this out of the hallway, because it was the plush St. Regis Hotel here, and it was very clumsy. So we went back to my room, and she called her agent, she called her manager, she called her next-door neighbor, she called everybody, and they all said, just give her the tape, it's no big deal. And of course I refused. And the mistake I made, this was going to last for hours, and the mistake I made was to lie down on the bed in the St. Regis Hotel, because I knew we were, like, captured. We were being held hostage. The next thing I knew, I opened my eyes, and, like, I felt a wind. She was gone, and the tape was gone.
Oh.
So she took the tape out of my purse and left with it. Now I am so furious. I was running through the hallways of the St. Regis Hotel going, oh, my God, this is robbery. This is a holdup. She stole my tape. She stole my tape. And now the studio publicist is scampering beside me and going, but please. And I said, I'm going to call the police. She said, don't call the police. Don't please, Grant. In her anxiety, she led me to Anne's room. I kicked open the door, and Anne is sitting on the top of the toilet lid getting her makeup touched up. And I said, give me the tape. She said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, you took my tape. You stuck your hand in my purse. You took my tape. I don't know what you're talking about. I leave. I'm going to go call my executive producer just to let her know that I am now calling the cops, and it's going to be a huge situation. She said, Franny, please don't call the police. I said, why not? She said, it'll get into the papers, which, by the way, it did. Anyway, I said, okay. She said, go take a walk and go back to the office and call me when you get there. I said, great. I go back there, I call her up. Now she's got the entire West Coast Bureau on the phone. And she goes, now what shall we do? And everybody said, call the police, have her arrested. So basically, by the time the police were called, Anne was already on a plane and she was met at the other side. But her people said, she does not have the tape. She does not know what happened to it. And the whole situation was dropped. But we did file a police report. And years later, I found out that she had instructed her personal publicist to toss it into a New York City sewer. So that's what happened there.
Did you ever get another interview with Anne Heche?
Yes. Yes. And it was so crazy because it was on a red carpet. And I don't know if she was pretending. You know, she was a very good actress. She didn't know me, or did she? I don't know. We just went on as normal, and she never mentioned it, and that was it.
There are more stories like this in Fran Weinstein's book, Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. I want to find out about your time with Robin Leach on the lifestyles of the rich and famous, and we'll do it right after this on What's on Tap.
This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max.
Welcome back. We're talking with Fran Weinstein. She is such an interesting person. She spent years interviewing celebrities, and she writes about it in her book, Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. Fran, I'm old enough to remember Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous and Champagne Dreams and all of that. You worked on that show. What was that like working for Robin Leach?
It was hilarious, actually, and sometimes painful. He could be kind of crotchety, but he was my mentor. He was my mentor. When I got to that show, I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I was just a hack. I went out with camera crews and we just did like news pieces, but I had no idea actually how to tell a story until Robin Leach took me under his wing. And he would assign me these stories and I would go to him and I'd say, I don't see the thing here. I don't see the story. And he'd say, Franny, you got to look for the little gem and blow it up into a bonfire. And so he taught me how to do that. And then I did start doing that. And I would go to him and I'd say, oh, my God, Robin, this princess of God knows what country we would do. She's fascinating. And he'd say, oh, Franny, she's just another hooker.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, he would say things like that. He was just so jaded. But the funny thing was, I was a single mother at that time. And so my deal with Lifestyles was not to travel and not to work nights or anything like that. So what I did was, all of these producers would go around the world to these luxurious, amazing, rarely heard of places. And they would bring back the tapes, tons of tapes, and I would write these pieces and cut them into, you know, 10, 15-minute pieces, and I was never there. But Robin would always say, give this to Franny. She'll make a gem out of this garbage.
You've worked on so many shows, and you've done it for so long, Fran. Mm-hmm. How have things changed now that we're in the digital age? Social media is such a product for anybody in the public eye. Would you be able to do your job the same way in today's atmosphere as you did, you know, 30 years ago?
I don't think so. Maybe I would, because Entertainment Tonight still is the number one entertainment news show in the world, we would still have that gravitas, and we could get major celebrities, of course, who would spend time with us. But now the stars are spread so thin, and, you know, they're just, they've got to do like 25,000 influencers because they're money-making propositions, you know, they're not to be scoffed at. So, you know, things have changed. The red carpets have gotten a lot bigger. When I first started on Entertainment Tonight, it was me and a couple of local news stations or the networks. But now the red carpets go on for blocks and blocks and blocks. So things have changed in that way. It's hard for them. You know, I think for me, it might have remained the same because of the status of a show like Entertainment Tonight.
Do you ever miss it?
You know what? I miss my crew, and I miss the people that I worked with. And I miss the lobbing of questions back and forth and the connections that I made. I don't miss the game. I don't miss the competition. I don't miss the running around in high heels. I don't miss the negotiations with the publicists, et cetera, for time and, you know, what I can ask and what I can't ask. And now, again, it's a whole different game because there are so many people that they have to deal with. So, you know, I miss the players. I don't miss the game.
And I bet you miss hanging out with George Clooney.
Oh, I do. I do. I do. He was amazing. He is amazing. He's amazing. And, you know, it's hard to find anyone that has, like, a negative thing to say about him. So,
Fran Weinstein, if you want to read more, it's a great book. It's called Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. It is about all of her adventures working in celebrity journalism and working the red carpets and all the people that she came in contact with through the years. Fran, I can't thank you enough for joining us this evening.
My pleasure, Libby. It was so much fun. Thank you.
This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max.
Did you know that since the 1970s, there have been more than 100 Bigfoot sightings in the state of Wisconsin? A lot of them have happened up north. As a matter of fact, in Marinette County, they've had 9 different ones. The most recent one was in July of 2018, when a police officer said he saw a Bigfoot crossing at a highway near Pembine. Now, they've seen them apparently in Crivitz. And they've also seen them in Vilas County, where the most recent Bigfoot sighting was in 2021. Well, guess what? There's going to be a search for Bigfoot right here in Jefferson and Waukesha counties this summer. And to tell us all about it is Emily Heller. She is with the Bridges Library System, and they've got over 24 locations in Waukesha and Jefferson counties. And Emily, I can't wait to hear about the search for Bigfoot in your library system.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having us on.
Are you actually going to have Bigfoot at any of the libraries?
Well, each Bigfoot has a character that you need to locate and see what kind of information that Bigfoot provides.
So how do you look for Bigfoot?
in a library?
So Bridges has a system-wide event each summer, and this year, just like previous years, players for our special event will go to each library location, walk around, and look for Bigfoot. Our Bigfoots will be located on posters somewhere in the building. And then when you find the Bigfoot, you get to collect stamps to add to your map.
And how many Bigfoot stamps do you have to collect in order to win a prize?
Well, this year we had decided that you could enter at every library you went. So that's up to 24 chances if you visit every location to win one of our prizes.
So you just have to get your stamps of the various Bigfoot in the libraries. Now tell me this, Emily. Do you have any Bigfoot books at any of the libraries?
Well, absolutely. Our collection throughout the library system is well over 2 million items, and many of those are Bigfoot, whether it's history of Bigfoot or other characters, both for adults, teens, and kids.
How popular are Bigfoot books in your library system?
Each library does a great job developing their collection, and I haven't heard stats specific to Bigfoot, but I know that our fantasy characters, not to say that Bigfoot is pretend, are always a very popular genre.
Oh, well, obviously Bigfoot is real. We know that because over 100 sightings have been in the state of Wisconsin since the 1970s. So will you have an actual Bigfoot during the summer at any of the libraries, do you think? Will he show up in person?
I hope so. I think Bigfoots love to read, and I expect them to pop into the libraries. If not, you could check out them on the poster, and they're going to share a fact with you about that particular library. So it's kind of fun to also look for Bigfoot, but learn a little bit something unique about that building.
Do you expect anybody to come in and tell you that they've actually seen Bigfoot?
I hope so. I would love to hear those stories.
Now, when does this all get underway?
This event runs June 1st all the way through Friday, August 21st. And within that time, you can visit libraries in any order that you choose and enter to win at each one. We just ask one entry per person.
And what is the big prize you can win?
So we are going to give away 12 different $50 gas station gift cards this year. Since people are doing a lot of traveling and coming to each library for this, we thought that was a nice thing that people would like to use.
Plus, it can help fund a trip up north to look for Bigfoot.
Yeah, absolutely. And who knows, maybe Bigfoot's right in your backyard. If you check out a book, maybe you'll figure out some tips on how to locate one.
So do you have to live in Waukesha or Jefferson County to participate?
No, there is no requirement to just simply participate. We do require that you have a Bridges Library Cafe card to be eligible to win one of the prizes. But if you just wanted to come by and look, you could do that.
How do you get a card?
Libraries across the state offer cards to their residents. Generally, they're free. All you need is just your residency information and pop into your local library and they'll get you set up.
And that search for Bigfoot in the Bridges Library System in Waukesha and Jefferson County gets underway on Monday, June 1st. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you so much. Happy hunting.
It has been a quick, fast-paced show. I really enjoyed being here with you. Sandy Max is on vacation, and that means I'm back with you tomorrow night. And we're going to be talking about the wit and the art of Dr. Seuss. Oh, this is a good one. You're going to really enjoy it. And so much more on What's on Tap. And What's on Tap is sponsored by Visit Milwaukee, handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org.